Viewpoint on Mormonism, the program that examines the teachings of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints from a biblical perspective. Viewpoint on Mormonism is sponsored by Mormonism Research Ministry. Since 1979, Mormonism Research Ministry has been dedicated to equipping the body of Christ with answers regarding the Christian faith in a manner that expresses gentleness and respect. And now, your host for today's Viewpoint on Mormonism.
So glad you could be with us for this edition of Viewpoint on Mormonism. I'm your host, Bill McKeever, founder and director of Mormonism Research Ministry. With me today is Eric Johnson, my colleague at MRM. As we briefly mentioned yesterday, we have a radio bill that is due, and if you like the show, Viewpoint on Mormonism, and would like to help support us in paying that bill, it would be most appreciated. If you could do that, just simply send a check to Mormonism Research Ministry at P.O. Box 1746, Draper, Utah, 84020. P.O. Box 1746, Draper, Utah. Or you can go to our website, mrm.org, and give a donation via PayPal. We would very much appreciate it. Again, if you enjoy the programs, you've been getting a lot out of what we've been doing here for you, and would like to keep them going, then by all means, we hope that you would support us in doing so. Bringing you up to speed regarding the movement of the Mormons, going from Ohio to Missouri, and now moving into Illinois. Joseph Smith is allowed to escape from Liberty Jail in 1839, and so he ends up joining his wife in Quincy, Illinois. But Quincy is not where the Mormons are going to stay permanently. In fact, our two authors in the book Mormon Enigma, Emma Hale Smith, Linda King Newell, and Valene Tippetts Avery, comment on page 82 how after Joseph Smith arrives in Quincy, he starts turning his attention and trying to find a permanent settlement for his people. He comes across a guy by the name of Isaac Galland. Galland was supposedly the owner of the land that Smith would eventually buy called Commerce, Illinois, and that Smith would move from Quincy to Commerce, and they say it was about 50 miles north on the east bank of the Mississippi. Joseph soon changed the name to Nauvoo, a name that he said meant the city beautiful. On May 9th, 1839, Emma is going to move her family into a small two-story log house, which they called the homestead. Eventually now, this is 1839. 2 years later, they would be celebrating the 11th anniversary of the church's founding. This would be on April 6th, 1841. And the authors note on page 93 that Joseph planned two large buildings for Nauvoo, a temple, and a hotel. That was the plan of Joseph Smith. And so when they're celebrating their 11th anniversary with a lot of pomp and circumstance, the authors note that there was a guest who watched the proceedings with increasing apprehension and anger. Whatever he saw or interpreted that day, Thomas C. Sharp, editor of the Warsaw Signal, went away a determined enemy of Joseph and the Mormons. Within 3 years, Sharp would launch a concerted attack against the Mormons, using polygamy as his focal point. Unknown to Sharp at this time, the authors write, Joseph Smith had already begun the practice of plural marriage in Nauvoo. Just the evening before, he had secretly married Louisa Beeman. And as we've discussed, there is a lot of controversy, even among Mormon historians, as to whether or not Louisa Beeman was really Joseph Smith's first plural wife. The list that you would get if you were to print off a copy of Joseph Smith's wives from the LDS computers in the Joseph Smith Memorial Building in downtown Salt Lake City does not include Fanny Alger as his plural wife. It lists instead Louisa Beeman. But Richard L. Bushman, the author of Joseph Smith, Rough Stone Rolling, he says that Fanny Alger, basically what he says is that Fanny Alger had to be his first plural wife. Otherwise, his relationship with her was certainly something that was unbecoming, we would think, for a true prophet of God. There's a lot of controversy in this. In fact, you were finding in George Smith's book, Nauvoo Polygamy, he mentions about 37 plural wives, 38 wives total, including Emma, and others would mention maybe 33 or 34. The question we are asking our LDS listeners is, how many is too many for you? Because in coming from my worldview, one is too many.
Well,
one plural wife,
yeah.
That's what I mean. One plural wife would be too many.
So whether it's 33
34, 37, when do you get outraged? Or do you ever?
And just how many were married to other men and how many were teenagers, all these different things. This is all documented, again, from LDS authors themselves.
Yeah, we know that about 10 of his plural wives were actually teenagers. And remember, he's in his 30s. Well, we get to chapter 7, and it's titled A New Order of Marriage. And it begins by saying,
on the evening of April 5th, 1841, Joseph Bates Noble crossed the river from Montrose, Iowa, and met Joseph Smith under an elm tree. 26-year-old Louisa Beeman, dressed in a man's hat and coat, stood at Joseph's side. With Joseph telling him the words of the ceremony, Noble married his wife's sister to the Mormon prophet.
Now, the thing is the authors in the very next paragraph will say that Joseph began teaching plural marriage in Nauvoo to Noble, who was not a member of the ranking councils of the church. But they say it's not surprising, since Hiram Smith, that would be Joseph Smith's brother, and Sidney Rigdon, which would be Joseph Smith's right-hand man at this time, had expressed their distaste for Joseph's involvements in Kirtland, and the 12 were still in England on their missions. Joseph swore Noble to secrecy, saying, quoting, "I have placed my life in your hands, therefore do not, in an evil hour, betray me to my enemies," end quote. Similar statements would accompany Joseph's instructions to others, indicating that he recognized plural marriage would bring upheaval to his people and perhaps result in his own death. I can't help, Eric, but go back to the only exception for polygamy, which is found in Jacob 2 in the Book of Mormon. And that is to raise up seed. If this is really the only exception, and God is needing to raise up seed, why is Joseph Smith keeping this to himself? Why isn't he announcing it to the rest of the members in the church so that they can do what the one exception says, and that is increase the population? Obviously, Smith's not going to be able to do that by himself. So he's keeping it secret, and he's only telling a few people.
Well, and we had talked about this last week, this whole idea of Joseph Smith being able to do what no Mormon would allow Thomas S. Monson to do, to be able to come up with revelation as he goes, and when it might be considered to be wrong for what he's doing, a Mormon would say, you shouldn't be doing that. Thomas S. Monson says, well, I got a revelation from God. That's not the way the church works today. Mormons don't believe that the prophet or the apostles can come up with their own rules and live according to their own standards and not make that available for everybody to do the same thing.
There has to be some sort of consensus among the leadership, the First Presidency and the Council of the Twelve. Now, at this time, there really was not a First Presidency as it's understood today. That would not happen until years later when Brigham Young would be officially granted the office of President of the Church, because after Joseph Smith's death, it was actually the Council of the Twelve that was running the show, and Brigham Young happened to be the president of the Council of the Twelve. So he was making a lot of the final decisions, but he didn't really become the official president till a few years later.
And this is not an open ceremony that took place when we talked about Beeman, because she's dressed in a man's hat and coat, and there's a secrecy part going on here that nobody's supposed to know this. Well, if this is something that God has intended, be proud, stand out.
You would think so, but as we've mentioned also, polygamy would not even be publicly announced until 1852, after the Mormons had already left Nauvoo and moved across the country into the Salt Lake Valley. And even then, it was not immediately after they got there. They arrived in 1847, and so we're talking about several years before it was officially announced in a general conference message, and Orson Pratt was given the quote-unquote honor of being able to announce it to the crowd and to the Mormon church. So there is a lot of secrecy involved in this, and certainly this secrecy allows us to come up with all sorts of wonderings of what's the thinking behind all this.
Well, listen to what the authors say at the bottom of page 95. Joseph kept his relationship with Louisa Beeman secret from all but a select few. He also kept it secret from Emma.
Now, I think we should stop there and ask our women listeners, how would you feel about that if you knew or found out through other voices in the community that your husband was secretly married to other women? How would you respond to that?
Well, certainly Emma didn't like it, and that's what they write. His earlier attempts to begin the practice in Kirtland had presented severe trauma for Emma, and Joseph knew that she would not willingly share him with another woman. Early in that summer of 1841, however, Joseph publicly tested the water for this new order of marriage. Emma sat in a Sunday morning service in the Grove of Trees, used as a meeting place, and listened to Joseph preach the restoration of all things as they were in the times of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob.
Now, it's interesting, those three patriarchs that are named here, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, because we see that same list mentioned in section 132 of the Doctrine and Covenants.
Yeah, let me read that. Verse 1, this is what it says. Verily, thus saith the Lord unto you, my servant Joseph, that inasmuch as you have inquired of my hand to know and understand wherein I, the Lord, justified my servants Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, as also Moses, David, and Solomon, my servants, as touching the principles and doctrines of their having many wives and concubines.
Now, some might say that seems like a contradiction to what was written in the Book of Mormon, where it talked about David and Solomon having many wives, which was an abomination to God. And the Mormons do have an excuse for that. That's talking about wives that they shouldn't have had, whereas this is talking about wives that were properly given to David and Solomon. But that's not the big problem I see in this particular chapter. Here's what I would like our listeners to do. I want you to go and look at section 132, verse 1, and read that over again, because there's another major problem that we see with verse 1, and it is repeated over and over when Mormons are called upon to try and defend the practice of plural marriage. We'll talk about that tomorrow.
Thank you for listening. If you would like more information regarding Mormonism Research Ministry, we encourage you to visit our website at www.mrm.org, where you can request our free newsletter, Mormonism Researched. We hope you will join us again as we look at another viewpoint on Mormonism. Is there not much of a difference between Mormonism and Christianity? Well, actually, despite what many may think, there is. And when it comes to the sensitive and even highly charged issue that has eternal ramifications, the Christian may not know where to turn. Just trying to understand the Mormons' beliefs can be both confusing and frustrating. That's why Mormonism 101 was written, a book resource by Mormonism Research Ministries' Bill McKeever and Eric Johnson that contrasts vital doctrines such as who is God, what is Scripture, and how a person is able to go to heaven. When the two religions are placed side by side, the differences are many. Mormonism 101 is a tool that will help you better understand the doctrines of your Latter-day Saint friend, family member, or co-worker. And it even has witnessing tips available to help you in future conversations. Published by Baker Books, Mormonism 101 is available at mrm.org or ask for it at your favorite Christian bookstore. As 1 Peter 3 says, always be prepared to give an answer.